The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
In a collection of koans called the Gateless Gate, there's a story about a young woman named Saijo. And the story of her is that she grew up in a village in China and grew up playing with her cousin, Ocho. And they were best friends. And as they came into puberty or so, they decided that they really were meant to marry each other and committed each other to be married when they grew up. However, the father of Saijo had different ideas for her, and he had arranged for her to marry some man from some other neighboring village. And so when the day came where the man came to marry Saijo, the cousin, Ocho, was quite upset by this, and his reaction was to run away. And he went on a boat and went up river. As he was going up the boat up the river, he saw along the bank of the river at some point a figure of a woman running after the boat. And so he went and looked closely, and it was Saijo running after him. And so he got her on the boat, and they went up the river some distance and started a life together. And after 5 years or so, they had two children and established a life in a different place. But Saijo missed her father and missed her own village and wanted to go back. And so they decided that maybe after 5 years, perhaps they can go back and ask for forgiveness and perhaps the father would receive them back, especially since they had children now and were established. And so they took a boat back down the river, and Ocho went up to the house where Saijo and the kids stayed behind on the boat. So Ocho went up to the father and knocked on the door and told him what had happened, and wanted to confess what had happened and asked the father for forgiveness and his blessing, and, you know, could he receive them back? And the father looked kind of oddly at him and said, I don't know what you're talking about. Because Saijo, the day you left, the day you ran away, Saijo took to bed. And she's been in bed, kind of in a half coma and a daze, ever since, all these years, here in the house. And Ocho said, well, there must be some mistake. She's down by the river. And father, no, there's no mistake. And come and look. And he came and look, and there she was, you know. So Ocho went back down to the river and brought up his wife, Saijo. And Saijo came walking through the village, the road towards her old house, the Saijo who was in the bed got up and came out of the house to greet the Saijo from the river. And when they greeted, they united and became one. The traditional Chinese folktale, apparently. In the Zen story from the Gateless Gate, Mumon Khan, the teacher, the writer, asks the question, which is the real Saijo? The one who stayed behind in bed? The one who went off to marry her childhood sweetheart? So that's a classic Zen question. But if we look at this story a little bit in our own lives, we start someplace really close, meditation. You've been sitting here meditating. And how easy is it to become split here? How easy is it to drift off for 5, 10, 15 minutes off into some fantasy world, into some thoughts, and wake up from that? Say, oh, where was I? You know, what was I doing thinking about my vacation or thinking about a job interview I have, or thinking about remembering some wonderful or terrible thing from the past, or just making up some pure fantasy about something, just living in this fantasy. And so if we get lost in this fantasy, there is not really awareness of ourselves here, present. So that part of us that can be present and alive and awake here, where is it? It's kind of like Saijo in bed, kind of not quite here, kind of not functioning. And what about the one that's off, drifting off in some wonderful, fantastic fantasy? Or terrible fantasy. Is that you? Is that who you really are? That's where the energy is. Do you identify with the fantasy, with the thoughts, with the feelings that come up, that take you away from being really embodied and present? And what happens if these two parts come back together? What does it mean to bring them together? What does it mean to connect them? So I think that we can see, easy enough in meditation, how easy it is to drift off and lose connection with oneself. And then when we lose that connection, who's the real one? The one that's drifting off, or the one that has been lost, been not connected to? And then in daily life, how easy is it to do the same thing? Have you ever been in conversation with someone and after a while wondered what they were saying because you were drifting off in some kind of thought? And you weren't present, the part of you that could be alive and present for something wasn't. And rather, kind of the fantasy went off. I've driven a car on the freeway sometimes and missed my exit because I was, you know, I think I was driving safely enough. I knew enough that I was there, what was going on, but I was so involved in my thoughts that I forgot, wasn't connected to what the purpose of my trip was and where I was going, and oh, I missed that exit. Simple things. But what about when we get caught up in strong desire? And I know I've had the experience, and I imagine some of you have, of being really caught by some desire and led down a certain path of life even, or a certain activity, and then some point wake up and say, what was I thinking? Sometimes, occasionally happens when we get burned by the desire. Oh no. And so we get into this fantasy world, or this we think that this desire, this thing we're going to is going to provide happiness and well-being. And so we get into that kind of world, but there's a kind of unawareness. There's a loss of awareness as we focus on the object of desire. And so who are we? Are we the one who's lost or focused in the object of desire, preoccupied with it? Or are we that one, or are we that part of, are we the person who's we've lost connection with? Who's the real you in these situations where we get split and divided? Fear is something that can split us quite a bit. People can get afraid, and in the fear create a very strong separation within themselves and outside of themselves between what they want to pay attention to or what they focus on. And sometimes fear, we have kind of selective attention, and we notice only those things which we think are frightening. Or we project a lot of, we are capable of projecting into the world around us frightening things that are not really there. So again, who are we? Are we that part that lives in a fantasy of projection? Or are we that part that we've lost touch with? It's easy to see, I think, in other people, or sometimes easy to see how other people put us in categories. You know, they don't see us as being complete to who we are. Sometimes we're seen as someone's spouse, or we're seen as someone's, you know, by a profession. Or we've, some point or other, did something nasty. And so forever after, we're always seen as a nasty person, even though that was the only one time we were ever nasty. Or we're seen by our ethnicity, or we're seen by our gender, or seen different kind of ways. And you kind of just want to knock that person on the head and say, hey, you know, wake up. I'm much more than that. You know, you kind of limited me. You put me in a box. It doesn't feel comfortable to be in this box. Sometimes it's easy to see how people do that to themselves. They limit themselves, they have this idea, I'm inadequate, I can't do it, or I'm a bad person, or I'm really the best person, or something. And it's a fantasy, it's an idea that we're living in, and some people can get caught in that idea, and there's a kind of loss of a certain kind of awareness, loss of a certain kind of inner connection to oneself. There's a split between So when we do it to ourselves, there can be a split between that part of us that we put on one side and that part of us we put on a different side. There's parts of us that were unacceptable. I know that when I was 14, I was going to boarding school and high up in the mountains, beautiful place. I remember one day walking along the road with a friend who was 17, and it was just awesome to be in this high mountain place with snow-capped mountains and blue, big expansive skies. And there's this tremendous, kind of almost religious feeling welled up in me. What's this all about? Why are we here? And my 17-year-old friend turned to me and said, "Don't be silly." Something that was so open just closed at that moment. That's not acceptable. So that's not something, I'm not going to go there. I'm not going to engage that part of my life. And there have been a variety of times in my life where people have made fun of me, where people have threatened me, people have harmed me, where the result of that was somehow I closed down and said, okay, that's not a place that's acceptable. I can't show that to people. I can't even show it to myself. I can't act on those places. And so who am I? Am I that person who's closed down, closed it all down? Am I that the other side of the wall, that which has been locked up and not paying attention? Who is the real you? What are the splits that we have? When I wrote my dissertation, or the Buddhist scripture that I studied for my dissertation, is a famous Mahayana text called "The Perfection of Wisdom in 8,000 Lines," and it's kind of a strange title, but the Perfection of Wisdom literature is seen as the kind of one of the foundations of the huge school of Mahayana of Buddhism called the Mahayana. And in the popular mind, people know about this. This particular text, it champions the philosophy of emptiness. Everything is empty. And in Mahayana, there's a huge philosophical commentary, philosophical treatises, explaining the profundity and the importance and the value and the truth of how everything is empty, the emptiness of it all. So I'm not going to go into the argument of how this all works, but you have to kind of believe me, that's considered to be one of the most profound things. So I had learned this in my years of Buddhist studies, but when I studied this particular scripture that seemed to emphasize emptiness, I was surprised by what I found in between the teachings on emptiness. There were, in fact, various teachings on emptiness in this text. Teachings were somewhat simplistic. It said over and over again in different forms, everything is empty. Everything's empty. Well, everything's empty, then you don't have to, if that's the only thing you know about something, you don't know much about it at all. And one of the things that happened in this movement, in Mahayana movement to this text, was that in making some kind of universal statement about how everything is empty, and people just see the emptiness of it all, and by somehow seeing the emptiness of it all, you could be free, they swept away the psychological emphasis of earlier Buddhism. Earlier Buddhism had a tremendous emphasis on self-awareness and become aware of how your inner psychology works, what drives you, what motivates you, what your attachments are, how you're split from yourself, to really understand all these things. And the function of mindfulness was to really kind of highlight this inner life. When everything is seen as being empty, then there was no need to look at all that. You were supposed to get it. You're supposed to see directly into the true nature of reality in some way, the empty mind, and overlook, not see the tremendous complexity of how the mind operates. So in between the teachings of emptiness, this text has this amazing discussion about a cosmic battle between Buddha and Mara. Mara is the Buddhist devil, kind of. The descriptions in the text of how people make spiritual progress has a lot to do with this battle, between this cosmic battle between these cosmic figures of this cosmic Buddha and this cosmic Mara. Someone enters the path with support of the Buddha, trouble with the path because Mara has gotten involved. One's involvement with a path or non-involvement with a path is not an issue of one's own will, one's own motivation, one's own inner understanding, one's own understanding of oneself, but rather is attributed to this cosmic phenomena outside of oneself. What I think the people who wrote this text believed all this. It wasn't just kind of myth. I think what you see is that as Buddhism swept away the earlier emphasis on psychology and self-understanding, there was still a need to explain causality, how things happen in the world. And so they described it magically, they described it mythically, they described it kind of these big forces outside of oneself. When we create a split inside of ourselves, a split where we don't see ourselves and understand what actually drives us, how we actually function, we still need explanations of why things happen to us. And one of the ways people sometimes will do it is by attributing it to forces outside or forces within us that we have no control over. Sometimes there's kind of deep, or very strong resorting to intuition. There's some deep intuitive knowing that, you know, that the fact that God is talking to me, that I should, you know, kidnap someone. You know, just know it. There's just deep, deep splits that can happen. And the function of Buddhist mindfulness practice, I would say, is to heal all these splits. So that, and the way we heal it is through awareness, through becoming aware, and then expanding our awareness to include more and more of what goes on within us. And and not to have a simplistic idea, this all is empty, or simplistic idea that the mind is empty, or that our true nature is consciousness or something, but rather to see clearly how it all works, or not all of it, but enough of it so that we begin understanding where our freedom resides, our freedom of choice, our freedom of how to act. Without being able to see where we have choice, there is no choice. If we don't see where the choice is and we still act in the world, then we have to kind of figure out some way to attribute the motivation, the impulse to act from. Did I say that kind of confused? So if we don't know, if we're acting in the world and we don't see how we have a choice in how we act, we still need to attribute responsibility to something. And so sometimes people attribute it to forces outside, sometimes to strange things within themselves. But if we see where the choice is, we see how the inner psychology works, there's less and less need to resort to kind of metaphysical or magical or kind of other kinds of ideas to explain how things work. One really sees, oh, that's why it is. When I'm afraid of strangers, and I seem to keep being afraid of strangers, maybe I'm afraid of something in myself. I knew someone who got really upset by the horrors of the world. They're horrors of the world. It's reasonable to get upset somewhat. But it was uncannily upset. And this person got particularly upset with the violence and cruelty to animals, to pets. And it was kind of like bizarre how much this person. And as we went into it and explored it, it turned out this person was so had been traumatized as a child in some kind of violence. And that was very afraid to touch that place of fear and pain that she had left over, legacy from her childhood experience. And so that fear, touching that, was somehow projected out to these, the cruelty to animals. Somehow the cruelty to animals was the way she placed her fear or her upset about her own pain. Or somehow it resonated with her own pain. That split and inability to deal with her own pain was projected out to this kind of sense of horror about what goes on outside. If we don't understand how we work within, then many times we don't understand how the world works. We don't understand how we relate to the world and why we react and respond to the world in the ways we do. So, Saijo, there were two Saijos. Which is the real Saijo? And I don't know the Zen answer to the koan, but that doesn't stop me. I think that neither was the real Saijo. And you could say, well, the real Saijo was the one that came together, was united. But that's a little bit too idealistic. I would like to say that I would like to suggest that the real Saijo was the two of them when they came to the road and they greeted each other. It was in the greeting, in the meeting each other, in the seeing each other, in the interest to go out and meet oneself. That's where the real Saijo is found. And because maybe we never completely come to the united, maybe there's always splits, there's always things that go on. But the willingness to turn and open up to oneself, to turn into oneself and see, oh, here. This is where I'm uncomfortable. This is how I'm afraid. This is how I'm lost in fantasy. So if you're lost in fantasy, in meditation, one approach after noticing that is to reject that. That's not really who I am. And I need to come back here and be embodied and present and awake, and this is who I really am. But I think that maintains a split between some ideal of me who is awake and present versus the me that gets drifts off into fantasy. What we can do in mindfulness is rather than rejecting the world of fantasy and that involvement, we can turn towards it and be aware of it mindfully. So with a sense of self-possession, in the sense of being having kind of be present and aware that here I am, and here I am a person who's fantasizing, and really see that, oh, here is fantasizing, and be present for it. Don't reject it, don't let go of it. The life force is bringing up fantasy at this moment. And then what is that about? What's driving the fantasy? I've known people, sometimes it's boredom. Sometimes it's compensation. I've had a hard day. This is much better. People on meditation retreats have told me that occasionally. I had such a hard time that in that one sitting where I spent the whole day sitting fantasizing because I just felt like I just deserved a break. Or sometimes it's fear. You don't want to face something. It's better to go and spend time in fantasy. So to become whole is not to reject the fantasy, but to turn towards it and really see it for what it is and see what drives it. To have be filled with desire for something, addiction for something, which is a great way to be split and lose touch with oneself. If we have the idea, I was supposed to reject my desire, reject my addiction, I shouldn't do that, and come back to some, I'm supposed to be a pure Buddhist person who has no attachments, no desires, and so I'll come back and steel myself up, sit up strong and straight, and be non-attached. That, I think, continues a split. Rather than rejecting something and coming back to some kind of ideal kind of way of being, what we can do in mindfulness is to turn ourselves 180 degrees around, awareness 180 degrees around. In other words, turn awareness away from the object of desire, turn it around all the way 180 degrees, and meet yourself subjectively as a person who has desire. What does desiring feel like? What's it like to be desiring? If we're blinded by the object, we might not see what really desire is happening, what's motivating it, what's causing it. And what's that really about? What's happening there? So in the story of Saijo, Saijo is, most of the story is presented as someone who lives in relationship to someone else. As a child, she's in relationship with her cousin, who's her playmate, and then at some point, someone who decides to marry her cousin. She's presented as someone who's a daughter of a father. She's presented as someone who becomes the wife of this guy. She's someone who becomes a mother. someone who wants to go back to be with her father. It's all about being in relationship. And some people, who they think they are, and very important part of who they think they are, is somehow found in relationship. It's not to be belittled. It's a very important part of life. But what happens if we... But when Sideshow met herself on the road and united, in that part of the story, there's nothing said about her being in a relationship to anything anymore. Can you be alive and present and awake without measuring yourself or defining yourself in relationship to anything? Relationship to people, relationship to desires, relationship to fears, relationship to, you know, bank accounts, a lot of things. Can you just be? So, in the case of, so the drive to be in relationship, to understand ourselves in relationship, is a big part of human life. What happens if we turn towards that? Enter into that world. What do we see there? Then we start seeing and unpacking many of the motivations and emotions and beliefs and ideas that go into supporting our desire to be in a relationship a certain kind of way or have a certain kind of relationship. So what I'm arguing here, suggesting here today, is that we don't want to split ourselves with mindfulness. We want to open up the mindfulness to be inclusive, to include. So rather than splitting it by some spiritual ideals, emptiness, some kind of ideal idea of being mindful and present, rather than splitting ourselves and saying some part of me is unacceptable and I shouldn't be doing that, I shouldn't be paying attention to that. What mindfulness, to be, have inclusive mindfulness is to see what's happening for us as it's happening and turn towards it in a certain way, turn towards it with mindfulness, with awareness. See, oh, this is what's happening, this is what's going on. And the more deeply we see what's happening, the more we inclusive include it all, the more we'll see that we have choice about how to act. We have choice. One of the very important forms of choice we have is the choice not to act, not to keep thinking what we're thinking, not to keep doing what we're doing. We might not have control over what our thoughts are, what our motivations and desires are. They bubble up. But we do have a choice about whether we act on them. And that's a very important freedom. We also have a choice at some point, because of that freedom to stop and not act on things, we also then have the choice to act in different ways, start thinking about different things, acting in different ways, saying different things. And that idea of choice is really at the heart of Buddhist practice, of developing our mindfulness inclusive enough that we see the array of choice clearly enough that we could start being free. The cost of freedom is awareness. And the prize of awareness is freedom. Freedom requires our ability to have choice. And choice requires our ability to be aware and really see what's going on. So who are you? Which Sideshow are you? Are you asleep in bed? Are you disconnected? Are you off chasing your dream up the river? What have you left behind? How are you split in some ways? How do you split? And what does it mean to become one again? And as a meditation teacher, I'm less interested in you becoming one as I am interested that you go out in the street and have the two meet, that you turn towards what's there, you meet what's there, that you discover what it's like to be inclusive. To have this, and to be inclusive includes it all, I hope, also means to have tremendous compassion for all of who you are and for all this, inclusive and present, willing to meet yourself, willing to include it all, however beautiful and however difficult it is. So, is that enough, or? Yeah. Yes, please. If you wait for the mic, then it'd be appreciated. It's going to him.
Why do you even need the one that was left behind?
Why do we need to know who's been left behind?
No, why was the one that was left behind even necessary? Why
was it necessary?
Why was the one that was left behind even necessary? Why not why was the upriver one not enough?
Oh, that's a very good question. Well, I think that whenever we're split from ourselves, there's seemingly almost an innate desire to be whole. And so, because there's a tremendous cost of being split. It takes a lot of energy, a lot of effort to not know part of ourselves and to have these barriers and walls. And so, to chase after a dream in such a way that it causes a split, divides us up, I think that it's painful. We become disconnected from part of who we are. So I believe that there's kind of a natural pull towards healing the splits that are there. If you sit quietly enough, pay attention, get sensitive enough, I think there's a desire for that to happen. And we see that. There's a lot of people who feel disconnected with themselves in some way. They engage in some very intense work for a long time, in a culture of work where they're focused only on their work and making money, and they realize after a while that it's a real cost, that they've left themselves behind, left their hearts behind. And so then they say, well, I have to find my heart, because it doesn't make sense to be around a computer terminal all day and not have real human connections. Is that an adequate answer? Yes? I'd love it if someday someone said, no, that didn't work for me.
Let me know if you can't hear. It's on. Okay. That story reminded me of two things. One is I just read a version of that story, and I think it's Jack Kornfield's After the Ecstasy, the Laundry, where he talks about it in terms of people's disconnection from their bodies. And it was very interesting interpretation of that, which I encourage people to look at. The other thing it reminded me of was a book I read a couple of years ago about Victoria Woodhull, who was the first woman to run for president in the United States, with Frederick Douglass as her running mate. So that gives you maybe an idea of when, in the 1860s, 1870s. So the book is very much about feminism and what women's lives were like then. And I don't remember the name, but there was a particular woman in the story, it's a real person, who was in an unhappy marriage and basically retired to her bed ill because she didn't want to have more children. And the comment was that there were a lot of women doing that who were essentially like Saicho in bed, apparently ill for no reason. And that the probable reason was that they were being forced to have children. So when I hear that Saicho story, I think, well, okay, did Saicho have any choice in realistic terms? That was a fantasy that she could only experience in her head. And the only way to stay out of a marriage to somebody she didn't want was to pretend to be ill or to become ill, essentially. Mm-hmm. Psychosomatic illness. Yeah. So I think we can look at it in terms of, if we have the freedom, are we denying a part of ourselves that we want? And you can also look at it as what happens when people are forced into things mm-hmm. by society.
Yeah.
And that's one of the things that happens is they can shut down like that.
Right. I think absolutely. Society, family, many things can create untenable, very difficult conditions, and some people's response is a shutdown. Some people's response is to run away. Some people's response is to attack and get angry. There's many responses, but they all kind of are responses that split. And it's easy in those kind of situations, it seems almost appropriate in those situations, to blame the difficult situations. Those situations are causing me to do this. When someone is engaged in Buddhist practice, the tremendous challenge of this practice is to learn to take back the responsibility to oneself. Realize that the split is within oneself. And it's very hard to overcome these kinds of shutting down splits, for example, when the world is so oppressive and people live under very oppressive conditions. But it's possible. And I don't know, what it requires someone to find that inner freedom that who live in oppressive conditions. But we certainly have examples of exceptional people who've done that in terrible conditions, who've stayed free. And right now, who comes to mind is Nelson Mandela. He was in this horrible prison condition, and he seemed to maintain his inner freedom in that oppressive situation. He didn't split. So what does it take? It certainly takes a lot of courage. And I think it also takes a willingness to be uncomfortable. It takes a willingness not to act, not to believe our fears.
I'm also reminded of a quote, short quote, which was from Alexander Graham Bell, saying that some along the lines of, sometimes we're so busy staring at the closed door that we neglect to see the open door. And so for me, that story is kind of like, well, okay, Saicho saw herself as having only two choices. And where is that open door? What would her other choice have been? Or what other choices might she have had if she couldn't just run away with?
Uh-huh. Yeah, it's a good question. There's an infinite number of choices, and the issue is not the choices. We look at the choices. The issue is, for Buddhism, is the freedom to have those choices. And so, what does it take? And so, I'm suggesting that mindfulness and the practice of turning towards everything and admitting everything, being present for everything, will show us the places of choice. And then we can, and then depending on causes and conditions and situations and many different things, we'll choose different things. And there's a huge array of choices that human beings have, not just two. And so, what is the most useful? And then the question is, of a whole array of choices we have, what are the most useful and important ones to act on? And since now it's time to eat, I won't go into that. Thank you very much, and I hope that those of you who'd like stay for the potluck, and if you have been here for a long time, if you would introduce yourself to someone who looks like they're relatively new, so they feel welcome, that would be great, and everyone's welcome to stay for the potluck. Thank you.